Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the White House steps up its lobbying for the Iran nuclear deal.
No one has put forward a legitimate, workable alternative other than raising the prospect of using the military option.
A plea to press Egypt to improve its human rights record. We continue our conversation on happiness with the question, can we all achieve it? And a row in the world of hip-hop. It's all ahead on The Voice of America. President Obama is stepping up his effort to gain congressional approval of the Iran nuclear agreement. He is expected to deliver a major speech defending the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, reached with Tehran in Vienna last month to curb its nuclear program in exchange for lifting of global sanctions. My colleague Victor Beatty is here in the studio, and he's been following this story. Victor.
Well, hello, Susan. White House spokesman Josh Earnest on Monday said the president is scheduled to deliver his remarks Wednesday at American University here in Washington.
To put it bluntly, the president believes that Congress should be supportive of an international effort to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon through diplomacy. No one has put forward a legitimate, workable alternative other than raising the prospect of using the military option. Now, the president's been clear that the military option is always been on the table, and it will continue to be. But if we have an opportunity to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon using diplomacy, the president believes that we should seize that opportunity.
Earnest says given Iran's support for terrorism, its menacing rhetoric toward Israel, and the detention of several Americans, the nuclear deal is one not based on trust, but rather on the ability to verify Iran's compliance. He says Tehran's past behavior makes the agreement to keep it from obtaining nuclear weapons all the more urgent. RAND Corporation Iran analyst Dalia Dasa-Kay told me the White House offensive comes as many U.S. lawmakers are expected to vote against the deal in a vote expected sometime next month.
There's a lot of forces working against the agreement. Unfortunately, it has become a very partisan issue, a lot of money being thrown at the campaign to try to defeat the deal. So I think the administration feels it needs to work against some of those anti-deal forces and try to explain the deal better to members of Congress and the American public. So what? I think this is very much expected when you're talking about a major foreign policy initiative.
Dalia, what do you expect the president to say in his speech?
I think he's going to make a strong case, not just that the terms of the deal are very good for U.S. national security interest and the interest of our allies, including Israel, which will be very important, especially in the congressional debate, but I think he's also going to make, or likely to make, a strong case that defeating the deal at this juncture would also have incredibly devastating consequences for U.S. security. So, you know, he'll make the case, the positive case, for why the deal is a good deal and serves our interests. But I think he's going to try to make it very clear, and this is especially targeted to members of Congress on the fence, that there will be a cost to be paid if they try to defeat this at this juncture, because he'll likely lay out the potential consequences of killing the deal, which the most notable ones would be the risk that Iran would be unrestrained in its nuclear capacity and would go back and return to enriching its uranium and moving toward a dangerously close position toward nuclear weapons capacity. And at the same time, if Congress kills the deal, there's concern that the international sanctions regime, now that this has been agreed to by the international community, if Congress kills this, that the sanctions regime would erode. So you'd have the worst of both worlds, an unconstrained Iran and a very weak international ability to confront and isolate Iran in that post-deal environment that, you know, where the deal has been rejected. So I think he's probably likely to lay out both the positive scenario as well as the potential consequences of failure.
Kay also says if fully implemented as written, the nuclear agreement, although not risk-free, does represent the most stringent verification regime ever negotiated in an international arms control agreement.
Well, thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Lobbying for and against the Iran nuclear deal is happening every day on social media. My colleague Michael Lippin joins us here in the studio with the latest. Michael, what are the lobbyists saying today?
Hi, Susan. Thank you. Well, let's start with the White House and its main Twitter platform for promoting the agreement, whose handle is The Iran Deal. A short time ago, that Twitter handle tweeted a link to a Washington Post story along with this message. Why the theory about just enforcing more sanctions against Iran would not reverse the Iranian nuclear program. Now, that article quotes two former U.S. officials who recently testified before the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. One of those former officials is Richard Nephew, who is the lead sanctions expert for the U.S. team negotiating with Iran. Nephew testified that, "I do not believe U.S. sanctions would stop Iran's enrichment program from moving." The other former U.S. official is Juan C. Zarate, who was President George W. Bush's deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism. Zarate said, "I think U.S. financial power and influence is enormous and would have an impact on Iran, but would it stop a nuclear program alone? I don't think so."
Well, Michael, what are you seeing on Twitter from the other side of the argument?
Well, one of the strongest opponents of the deal is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whose handle is @Netanyahu. He tweeted that he would be making his case in a live webcast at 1 p.m. Washington time on Tuesday, which is around now. And that live webcast was due to be hosted by the Jewish Federations of North America, whose handle is @JFederations. Well, there's a big battle going on right now within the American Jewish community to persuade American Jews to either support or oppose the deal. American Jews are quite politically active compared to the rest of the U.S. population, which is why so many people are lobbying them right now. Susan?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
As the old saying goes, what goes up must come down. And researchers say the land located beneath the Chesapeake Bay in the eastern United States is rapidly sinking, and that Washington, D.C. could drop 15 centimeters or more within the next century. Land dropping beneath the U.S. capital city could exacerbate a rise in sea level, which is forecasted due to melting ice sheets and climate change. Geologists have thought for decades that the land surrounding the Chesapeake Bay, once pushed upward by the mass of a prehistoric ice sheet, is now settling back down since the ice has long since melted. The researchers from the University of Vermont point out that their data indicates that the land around the Washington area is not sinking primarily because of human-related activities. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Days after the U.S. delivered 8 F-16 warplanes to Egypt as part of military support, Secretary of State John Kerry restarted the so-called strategic dialogue with Egyptian officials in Cairo. Kerry said the administration is committed to working with Egypt to enhance its military capabilities as it confronts growing threats from extremists, particularly in the Sinai Peninsula. Secretary Kerry also acknowledged stress in the U.S.-Egypt relationship over human rights and said Washington would continue to press Cairo on the arrests of dissidents and journalists and mass trials. But does the U.S. have any leverage to pressure Egypt? International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy is joining me here to discuss this issue. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you, Sue, for having me. The answer to your question is simply yes. That's why a group of U.S. Congress members asked Secretary Kerry to use the opportunity of the resumption of strategic dialogue to press the Egyptian government to improve its human rights record. Also, the Working Group on Egypt, which comprises a team of scholars and experts on Egypt and democracy, sent Secretary Kerry a letter with the same message. Steve McInerney, Executive Director of the Project on the Middle East Democracy, is a member of that team.
I do believe that the United States still does have quite a bit of leverage with the Egyptian government and with the Egyptian military if it chooses to use this leverage. Of course, if the administration believes that it has no leverage, this can be self-defeating. However, the Egyptian government still very much needs its relationship with the United States. It certainly needs the support, not only in direct assistance, but also in training and partnership that it receives from the U.S. military. And it needs diplomatic support from the State Department and the U.S. administration. I strongly believe that if the administration were willing to use its leverage, it could have some influence on the Egyptian government's behavior.
But what kind of steps are needed to be taken by the Egyptian government? Any specific recommendations?
Actually, the Working Group on Egypt provided Secretary Kerry with a list of recommendations.
First, we would like to see the Sisi government revise its approach to counterterrorism, including to bring Egypt's counterterrorism legislation, its counterterrorism laws, into line with the requirements of Egypt's constitution, as well as its international human rights commitments. In the same lines, we'd like to see the Sisi government overhaul its strategy toward insurgency in Sinai, to adopt more effective security methods, along with strategies on the political and economic front, to try to support political and economic development and the rights of the local population in a way that will encourages the cooperation of the local population rather than alienating and disenfranchising. Third, we called for the Sisi government to bring an end to all politically motivated trials, to annul all politically motivated death sentences and other harsh punishments that have been handed down in trials that are far short of international standards for due process and fair trials, and to release all political prisoners that are currently being held with insufficient compliance with the due process of law. Fourth, was the need to bring an end to the Egyptian government's assault on independent civil society organizations, including human rights organizations, as well as on both local Egyptian and also foreign journalists, press, and free media. And finally, we think it's important that the Egyptian government initiate genuine processes, procedures, for national reconciliation, to begin to bring about a reversal of the very stark social and political polarization that we're seeing now in Egypt.
However, Steve McInerney acknowledged that the Egyptian government is trying to use the renewed strategic dialogue with the United States as a sign of U.S. endorsement of its current repressive policies, and he strongly warned against going back to the old U.S. policies of preferring stability over democracy.
Unfortunately, I think the United States is going back, in many respects, to its older approach, to its old sort of flawed and unsuccessful approach of stability first. We should have learned that our approach under Mubarak was only successful in a narrow sense at providing narrow short-term stability, and I fear that we're making the same mistakes again. However, now, in the current situation, we're really not even seeing short-term stability provided by the Sisi government, as the levels of violence are continuing to escalate, and the reality is that Egypt is less stable now than it's been at any time in decades. So I do think that Sisi's approach of trying to bring stability through harsh political repression and targeting of any political dissent or opponents is failing. And I think that the United States is mistaken to be backing this approach.
Mohammed, thank you for bringing this to International Edition.
Thank you, sir.
In business news, Chinese stocks bounce back and investors take a bite out of Apple. Reporter Alexis Christophorus joins us on the line from New York. Alexis.
Thanks, Susan. Chinese stocks rose as Beijing clamps down on short selling. The Shanghai Composite Index ended up nearly 4% to 3,756. Hong Kong's Hang Seng was basically flat. Officials announced revised rules on short selling to curb volatility. Under these rules, short sellers must wait at least one day to cover their positions and pay back loans used to buy shares. It used to be that investors could cover their positions the same day, and that made for a lot of volatility. The new rules on short selling are just the latest measure Chinese regulators are taking to stem a 27% drop in stocks since mid-June. And worries about the Chinese economy is helping to send shares of Apple to a six-month low. That stock is lower for the fifth straight day. The maker of the iPhone and iPad is now more than 10% below its record close of $133 a share back in February, and that means Apple's stock has officially entered correction territory. Investors are concerned that an economic slowdown in China could hurt Apple's bottom line, since China is Apple's biggest growth market. There's also worry that Apple's smartphone is saturated in developed nations. Still, Apple stock is up 7% for the year. It had been up as much as 22%, and some analysts call the recent sell-off overdone. Susan?
Thanks, Alexis, for that from New York.
You're welcome, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, Girl Scouts always carry a smile in their pocket. Our expert will help you find one in yours. And some definite frowning in the world of hip-hop. We've been speaking with Jim Jensen. He's the author of the book, Seven Keys to Unlock Your Full Potential. And today we continue our conversation. Jim, how easy is it to achieve happiness? Can we all do this?
We all have the capacity to do it when we learn how to do it. And there's a specific methodology in which we can bring about change in any areas of our life. In fact, if your audience wanted to see more, they could go to my website, which is 7keystounlock.com. But we were talking earlier about how the subconscious is like the hardware on a computer. It's where we store data. That's one of the primary functions of the subconscious. And if we don't know how to change that data, which we can deliberately do by input through the conscious mind, but if we don't know how to do that or we don't learn how to do that, then we really kind of become, you know, prisoners of our own data. And a lot of people just go through life saying, well, I'm good at this. I've never been good at this. You know, I'm just lousy. I just got a short draw there, but I am good at this over here. And then the behavior follows how they describe themselves.
You know, Jim, this sounds like information that parents could use to help make their children grow up to be happy adults.
You know, what we talk about, we tell people that we really are talking about the qualities and characteristics of high-performance people, and not just how we might be more productive of our work, the ability to make more money, but in relationships, in parenting, teaching, coaching, in personal health. We can control and change any of these things that we want. You know, it's interesting, Susan, 50 years ago, although these techniques have always been applicable, and they were taught 50 years ago, but you had to kind of take a leap of faith to either believe or disbelieve. But today, through quantum physics, this is all scientifically proven. In fact, Bruce Lipton, who wrote The Biology of Belief in Spontaneous Evolution, says, our minds actively co-create the world we experience. Consequently, by changing our beliefs, we have an opportunity to affect world change. The fact that the mind is the observer influences the outcome of experiments is one of the most profound insights introduced by quantum mechanics. This new physics acknowledges that we are not merely passive observers of our world, but rather we are active participants in its unfolding. Quantum physics has absolutely verified that information processed by our minds influences the shape of the world in which we live. Isn't that powerful?
It's amazing. Well, thank you so much, Jim, for speaking with us.
Oh, it is my pleasure, Susan, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, thank you. And this is a happy VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon recently visited Norway in an attempt to raise awareness of the upcoming climate change conference.
This looks magnificent, but at the same time, I'm alarmed that there are so many cracks in may soon break. They are melting very rapidly.
The United States, European Union, and China announced their proposed carbon pledges for the conference. But Samantha Smith of the World Wildlife Fund says via Skype, the pledges don't go far enough.
There's already a big gap between what's needed to really fight climate change and what many countries and industries are doing today. We do need to see more urgency, more political will, not necessarily just from the United Nations, but actually from the countries that are doing the negotiations.
Member nations will meet in Paris later this year to try to sign off on a new international carbon-cutting agreement. For VOA's Greenbeat, I'm Rebecca Ward.
In hip-hop music, authenticity is a big deal, but a recent conflict between Meek Mill and Toronto-based MC Drake has flared over whether Drake writes all his rhymes. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Soul Lounge host Shawna Renee to get details.
Let's start at the beginning.
Yes.
Okay. Meek Mill, who...
In the beginning, there was the Meek one.
There was the Meek one, who, better known as Nicki Minaj's boyfriend.
Okay.
For people who may not be into contemporary hip-hop music.
All right.
Anyway, he has a new project, and Drake, who almost everyone knows, he's hugely successful, Drake did a cameo on the project. And so Meek Mill was a little upset about the fact that Drake did not promote the project the way that, according to Meek Mill, they had originally agreed he would.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took to Twitter and said, you know, I'm angry with Drake essentially for not promoting it, but the reason he didn't promote it is because Drake doesn't write his own rhymes.
Okay.
That's like the worst thing you could say about...
Now, Meek said this about Drake.
This is what Meek said about Drake.
And I understand it's only like one verse that was in dispute or something.
On his record. But he kind of implied that it wasn't just the verse on Meek's record that was not written by Drake, but implied that it was also, there were also verses on some of his own, meaning Drake's records, that had not been written by Drake.
Now, why is this a beef, though? I mean, singers have been singing other people's words for, you know, centuries.
Right. Well, in hip-hop, it's a little different. You can kind of look at hip-hop the way you would poetry. So it is a very personal expression of someone's experience, someone's feeling. It is. It started off as being, and continues to be in its purest form, authentic.
Right.
Authenticity is very important, as you said in the beginning. So while it has always also been a collaborative process, most hip-hop artists, most hip-hop writers, people who write raps, do so about their own experiences and wouldn't necessarily hand it over to someone else to do. Now that hip-hop has become more popular, and people are writing hits as opposed to just writing songs, you will have folks who know what it takes to create a hit come in and write verses.
Ghostwriting.
Yeah, ghostwriting.
They called it ghosting.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Drake was being accused of. But Drake has come out.
Ghosting instead of toasting.
Instead of toasting. Right, there you go. Such a funny man. So that's why it's a huge deal, because Drake does present himself as someone who is authentic.
All right. Well, we will see if the beef continues. If you have any comments about this, you can send Shauna a tweet. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA_music. And you can send us a tweet at VOA_IE. Listen also for Shauna in the Soul Lounge on www.voanews.com.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team here.
Thanks for joining us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
500 of sub-Saharan Africa's most promising young leaders have gathered here in Washington to meet with President Barack Obama and leading U.S. entrepreneurs, government officials, and civil society representatives. The three-day summit, August 3rd, 4th, and 5th, will do more than that, however. It will also underscore our nation's commitment to Africa's people, democracy, and governance, and highlight our commitment to addressing issues that affect us all. Increased engagement with the nations of Africa is a high priority of U.S. foreign policy. President Obama has emphasized how important this relationship is, beginning with his traveling to Ghana soon after taking office in 2009. The presidential summit follows 6 weeks of academic study and leadership training for the 500 fellows at 20 institutions of higher education across the United States as part of the Mandela Washington Fellowship. The event will also feature a town hall with President Obama, a plenary session with members of Congress, and breakout discussions with leaders in business, government, international development, and non-governmental organizations. Forging stronger personal connections among these young leaders advances America's and Africa's many, many shared priorities. It also fosters further future engagement and deepens the partnership between the American and African peoples as we both pursue a better future for us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.